As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's Coolest Conversations podcast time at Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks for listening. Please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is Andy Chernoff, one of the founding members of the seminal proto-punk band The Dictators. Andy is the lead singer, bass player, and primary songwriter. The group formed back in the early 1970s and over the decades issued 5 studio and live albums, but the past 10-plus years have been dormant until now. Andy and the 2 other original founding members have reformed and begun to release a series of singles, with the appropriately titled Let's Get the Band Back Together being a recent coolest song in the world. We hear some of that now, followed by my interview with Andy Chernoff on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
It's changing in the weather. The music is forever. Never say never.
Let's get the band back together.
Manfred here, and my guest today for our Coolest Conversations is musician, songwriter, producer, and founding member of The Dictators, Andy Chernoff. Hey, Andy, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, considering, Manfred.
Oh, man. Well, a lot has transpired since we chatted, last in November of 2019. Mm-hmm. Have you and your loved ones managed to stay safe and healthy over the course of the past year?
Yeah, we feel very lucky. I got my 2 shots. My wife got her first shot yesterday, and we live in a sort of a rural part of Hudson Valley, so we can get out. You know, we don't feel as trapped in New York City, and it's been, you know, a little crazy, but we feel lucky.
So incidentally, I just happened to get my first shot yesterday as well. My arm sure is sore. How's your wife doing?
She's not doing well, actually. She's not feeling good, and she has work to do. I had nothing from both the shots. I'm a sturdy, you know, Russian bear. So my wife is not feeling so well from the shot.
Which vaccine did she get?
She got the Pfizer, which I got also, and I heard it's less likely to have side effects.
Yeah, well, I got the Moderna, and it's like, you know, my arm is definitely still sore. And but anyway, best of luck to your wife. I hope she gets through the rest of the day without, you know, feeling any worse, gets better.
Yeah, she's just worried about something. We'll survive. Could be worse problems, Manfred.
Really? Well, this week's coolest song in the world is a brand new single from the legendary Dictators, appropriately titled Let's Get the Band Back Together. And your reformed lineup includes the 3 original members. There's Ross the Boss, Scott Kempner, and yourself. But as you know, last week news broke that Scott won't be able to remain active in the lineup due to health reasons. Getting the guys back together, recording some new songs, having to bow out, it's got to be an emotional roller coaster. How are you dealing with all this?
Yesterday, when we announced it, it was a really tough day because we announced it on Facebook and there was a lot of tribute. Just let me, so people know, it's not a secret. Scott is okay. He's fine. And I talk to him all the time, but he has a early stage dementia. It's something he inherited from his father. So, you know, it interferes with him working with the band. His sister said, hey, maybe we just announced that he can't play with the band. And we agreed on doing that. And he's okay. And he's, you know, hopefully long-term perspective, we'll see what happens.
Now, I think that like with the Sonics, you know, Jerry
Rosalie doesn't, there's in a stage where he can't really ever tour or play out, but they'd hope that maybe he could continue to contribute at some point. Is that even in the a possibility with Scott, or is it just?
No, this is the thing. I talked to him about it. Hey, Scott, how about a song? Got any ideas? And I guess part of it, he says, yeah, I got some ideas. I'm gonna work on it. And then he doesn't send me, and I call him back. And, you know, so I guess it's part of, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what stage Jerry Rosalie is in, but Scott is fine. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
He's not, he's far from suffering. He can enjoy life. He plays his guitar. And, you know, we talk to him, but we'll see. We're worried about, you know, the long-term progression is really the concern on our part.
Was it in 1972 when you guys originally formed the band?
I think it was 72. We started talking about it. Mm-hmm. And then we've got a farmhouse in Cahuenga, New York, near where I am now. And we, for $150 a month, and we just went through a series of drummers. And so I say 73. Scott always said 72 because I'm not sure why he says that, but somewhere around that
in the early 70s. Well, you had a fanzine, the Teenage Wasteland Gazette. Now, you had figured to become a rock writer before being a musician?
Yeah, I was kind of a obsessive reader of magazines at the time, and I started my own magazine, and I said, hey, maybe this could be a career, because I sent it out to Richard Meltzer and Lester Bangs and Nick Tosh's, and they all loved it. They became friends of mine. They sort of mentors to some degree. And I thought rock writing, hey, maybe I could do this. But, you know, the band came along and I decided, you know, do the musician thing.
You know, I hadn't thought of this before, but it just occurred to me. You mentioned those guys sort of being your mentors. Would you think, were any of those three guys kind of frustrated musicians in their own right?
No, those three weren't. I think other guys might have been. But Meltzer wasn't a musician. Even though he had a band, he was a singer in a band called Vom in L.A. back in the late 70s, 80s, I think. You know what? Lester Bangs had a band, too. With Mickey
right,
Lake.
With Joe Ramone's brother, right.
Nick Tosh's, I don't think so, but he gave up rock writing a little earlier and became like a, you know, biographer, books of the dark arts. I think they did have aspirations.
So, well, let's think here for a moment. You have been doing the writing thing. Ross, he was already playing gigs with a cover band at the time before you guys formed.
When we formed?
Yeah.
Yeah. He had a band, but he was kind of ready to leave, and he actually came up to me one day and said, I'm gonna leave the band, and I said, hey, I'll be the bass player. He goes, okay. I didn't own a bass.
But did you play bass at the time?
No. I think he said I'm thinking about getting Scott on guitar, because Scott owned the guitar. Now, he never played that guitar outside of his bedroom, but he owned the guitar. And I said, I'll play bass. And he goes, okay. So I bought my bass. I bought it on February 14th, 1973. I remember, because that's the day Dave Bowie played Radio City Music Hall. Yeah, so we were total amateurs. We didn't we had not done our 10,000 hours of preparation.
Well, there's one more thing about you guys forming early on that I read that I thought was pretty fun and pretty cool. Was having to do with Scott, and you mentioned, you know, he was playing kind of guitar really just in his bedroom. But something else about you guys knew that he liked the Stooges, and it was kind of like, hey, he likes the Stooges. We know he can play a guitar, at least in his bedroom. That's his ticket to stardom.
Yeah, Scott had great taste. This thing about Scott, he was always a sort of rock and roll historian, record collector. And in those days also, weren't that many Stooges fans. If you met a Stooges fan, it was kind of like a brotherhood. You immediately felt you were connected to the other person. But it worked. It was great. You know, we had a good run. We had a great time, and we're still doing it.
Well, you know, I read that you described Ross as being the musician in the band, yet you're the songwriter. especially early on when you're figuring out how to play the bass, was that ever a conflict with him?
I played guitar. I grew up with taking piano lessons and
clarinet lessons.
And my mother played guitar. You know, I had an aunt who was a music teacher. My next door neighbor, you know, next door neighbor was in the New York Philharmonic. Used to go see, you know, I was, my parents played music. They did Hoot Nannies in their living room. I was surrounded by music growing up. And I was always banging on the guitar and the piano. So I knew how to play.
All right. So when you said, hey, I'll play bass, not knowing how to play bass, it wasn't just out of thin air. I mean, you were familiar with playing instruments.
True. But I never played a bass before.
Right. You know, so as we're talking here just now, it just reminds me, you know, you have a great sense of humor. The band always had this irreverence. Man, when Go Girl Crazy comes out in 75, I mean, how disappointed were you that people didn't seem to get it? I mean, was that just crushing?
Yeah, well, I was crushed. Yeah, I was young, and I left the band for a while. I felt like a failure. My songs, you know, it's heartening to see it being re-released over and over again. And
Yeah. Still,
people still talk about it. It's sold a lot more over the years than in the first few months. But, you know, how can a major label sell an album like that in 1975? It's impossible. You know, we just gave them a product that they couldn't market. I can see that now, 2020 hindsight, but...
Was that because of the excesses of the industry overall that they just...
There was no punk rock. There was no MTV. There was no Sex Pistols. There was no Ramones. There was CBGB's was just getting started. It was in the Lower East Side with drugs and crime. No city had punk rock bands, and no city had a clubs for punk rock bands to play in. And then in 76, Toronto, Boston, LA, all these things started, sprouting. And 77, it became a little more obvious that there was an actual scene happening. But in 75, it was a wasteland.
Well, you said something there about leaving the band, but were the other guys continuing on without you for a couple of years?
No, just a few months.
Probably. Just a few months, right.
Yeah, okay. That's why they wanted to continue. They got a bass player and drummer. That's why there's a different rhythm section on the second record.
Right, and you come in and play keyboards then.
Yeah, they said, come back, play keyboards, which was in a way a mistake because I really should be playing bass because I'm writing to write more on guitar. We were kind of a little bit lost at that time. You know, when you have a failure in your first record, then we overcompensate on the second record. Third record, we sort of found our grounding and we've been okay ever since, you know.
And Blood Brothers, we're talking about as a third.
Yeah, Blood Brothers with the two guitars, bass drums. You know, that's the sound of the band. My songwriting came together a little more focused, you know. But, you know, we started, you know, from the time Sandy Pearlman saw us and said, I'll get you a deal. From the time we formed, the time we got a deal, it was about a year, maybe less than a year. It was pretty amazing, you know.
Yeah.
We didn't do what 10,000 hours, as I said.
Right, meaning that, you know, you should be putting in that much effort before you get signed. So as opposed to...
Yeah, what's the author, Malcolm Gladwell, had a book, and he said, the Beatles were successful because they were 10,000 hours working in Hamburg, playing, you know, eight sets a night, you know, six nights a week or seven nights a week. I don't think we played a gig when we got signed. Me and Scott were amateurs. Ross was a good guitar player then.
You mentioned the album... Go Girl Crazy, you know, being reissued and over the years, and you're seeing this influence. Do you think, I mean, I get this vibe anyway, you know, there's this, the bands like Velvet Underground, they didn't sell very many records when they were really together, but they were consistently influential since then. Do you feel like, I mean, I feel like the Dictators are in that same kind of boat.
We are. I mean, we never had big hits, but I've had a career.
Yeah.
To make music every day is a gift. To be able to make money playing music is the blessing that music gave me, you know. Lou Reed became kind of a pretty successful after the Velvet Underground, you know?
Yeah, you're right. Well, that's like the last thing I really want to get from you is you've made it, you've been able to keep a career in music. Has there ever been a moment where you just thought, man, this was fun for a while, but I've really made the wrong choice here. I got to figure something else out.
Actually, yes. And this is how lucky my life has been. Around 2004, 2005, it's when like Napster was happening and some of my income was producing bands, but I was producing like, you know, bands, small labels. Yeah. And everything was drying up in 2005. And I got the offer to work with a friend of mine, Jean-Luc Ledoux. He's a French guy who was in the wine business. And he said, I'm opening a store. You want to come and work for me? It was perfect timing, right when things were, I say, oh my word, you know, things were getting weird in the music business. And I worked for him for 5 years. You know, I something, it was a hobby of mine I was involved in, and I really got to taste some of all the great wines in the world. It was a great experience from 2005 to 2010. So the answer to your question is, yeah.
Well, what made you put the cork back in the bottle, so to speak, and refocus on music?
What happened was my parents got ill, both my parents. Uh-huh. And I had to sort of take care of them. Mm-hmm. You know, they were in New York, thankfully. They both passed away by 2011, 2012. And then by that time, I was starting to, I decided to play solo. I used to play at this club called Lakeside Lounge.
All right.
I played every Wednesday at 7 o'clock after work. Not every week, but I'd say about two-thirds of the year, and I had a small little band. I worked out my songs, and I made some solo EPs. It was, you know, just my way back to making music. Though I wasn't completely, like, in 2008, The Dictators, we went to...
Spain, maybe?
Went to Spain.
Yeah.
In 2006, we played the closing nights at CBGB. So I wasn't completely out of music business. I just wasn't thinking about it every day.
Well, very cool. We know the band has gone through inactive periods before, and you've been successful, you know, being able to make a living, continuing to make music on your own, and being involved with the songwriting and producing. Why start working as the Dictators again? Why reform the band?
I'll tell you, it was the last thing on my mind, Manfred, honestly. I never thought I would ever play in a band called the Dictators again. But there was some Dictator business that brought me, Scott, and Ross together. Mm-hmm. And me and Scott, we've always been best buddies. But we kind of lost touch with Ross. And through this business thing, it brought us together. And once it was solved, Ross goes, hey, let's reform the original band and play. And I was like, oh, well, I don't, you know, it's not really on my mind. Was not in my agenda, but Scott was enthusiastic. So I said, let me think about it. And I thought about it. I said, okay, let's give it a try. And this was in 2019.
Okay.
I said, after the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, let's talk about it in January 2020. So January 2020, we start talking about, hey, what songs you want to do? What do you want to do? And everybody's located in different places. So it's all email and phone and whatever. And then, of course, for the pandemic.
Yes.
And made it more difficult, but it made me really, I'm happy that I rejoined the band.
Yeah.
Restoring the band, because it kept me sane over the past year. We had a lot with, you know, we're doing recording and videos and just organizing things is a job every day. So I'm thankful that Ross wanted to do it.
Often I see the Dictators labeled as being a proto-punk band, which I guess puts you guys on a timeline. But I think of you simply as being, you know, a rock and roll band, drawing on earlier rock and roll music as influences, but, you know, creating music that's honest to your own experiences, perspective. What are the Dictators to you?
We're a rock and roll hard rock band. Two guitar is the you know, two guitar lineup like MC5 or Slade. These are things that we modeled ourselves after.
Yeah.
But our tastes are all over the place. You know, we like surf music. We like garage rock. We like hard rock. We like some heavy metal. We like pop music. And we like punk. And there are serious aspects of punk in the band, particularly in the lyrical end. It wasn't an easily digestible thing to market, like the Ramones. You see them, they got a sound, it's amazing. Dictators are all sorts of things, and every record sounds different. So, you know, hey, we are what we are. We play rock and roll music. We just try to stay true to ourselves and true to the history of rock, and that's what we do. And we're lucky now that we don't really care really how successful we are. We like making music. That's what we're trying to do. You know, we're obviously want more people to like us, and we're happy that Steven will play the record. But, you know, the joy of making music every day is pretty much what we're about at this point, because we're all older guys. We have a new drummer, Albert Bouchard. He's made the Blue Skull. He's a world-famous cowbell player. He played cowbell on Don't Fear the Reaper. And, you know, we just enjoy being creative together. And hopefully people will like what we turn up.
Well, let's talk a bit about Albert, because I know, you know, early on you worked with Sandy Pearlman as a manager and producer. And he of course, worked closely with Blue Oyster Cult. Is that when you first met Albert back then?
Yeah, we met Albert back around 73, 74. And then we have shared manager producers. But over the years, I've played with Albert on different projects, different recording projects, and Ross has also, and Scott has also. Hmm. So, and I love Albert. I love his drumming. He's really contributes a lot more than just drums. He's a cowbell player. That's pretty important, right? Yeah. He, you know, he's a songwriter. He's a producer. He's an arranger. He's a singer. He really offers a lot to the band, and we're really thrilled to be playing with him.
So was he your go-to man when you were thinking about trying to find a drummer?
You know, when Ross said, hey, let's get the band back, I said, what do I want to play with? I thought of Albert immediately, and I suggested it. And we first asked him, hey, do you want to just play? We're going to do some recording, like four songs. Do you want to play on it? He said, yes. So, and over the process of discussing the songs, doing some rehearsals, we said, hey, it was obvious he was working. It's obvious we enjoyed playing together. And we said, hey, Albert, you want to be in the band? And he said, of course. So very smooth way we work the band these days.
Back in January, you released a new single called Goddamn New York. And we'll hear that in a few minutes. And I mentioned this week's coolest tune in the world is Let's Get the Band Back Together. Did you record these songs at the same time?
Yeah. And, June, when restrictions opened up, we went into a studio and we recorded tracks for four songs, guitar, bass, and drums. So we took those tracks and then we added vocals, added solos, added background vocals, worked on arrangements. And but we have four songs in the can. We're going to release another song in hopefully July. And we have a very, very special holiday song celebrating Festivus. scheduled for the end of the year.
Well, a Festivus song. I better clean up my pole and get that ready.
Absolutely. Prepare to air the grievances.
the list is long and mighty, always as appropriate for Festivus. You mentioned so a total of like four songs coming out over the course of the year. I mean, I've heard of trickle down economics. Is this trickle down releases, single every so often? Well, what's the long-term plan? Will there be an album?
At this point, since we can't tour the, and if we made an album, I don't know, where do we sell it? So the plan is to release a song every few months, and we'll see what happens in 2022. We expect that maybe we could start playing then, and then we can compile what we have and sell it when we play and maybe do a deal with some record label. Right now, we're just trying to get the songs out. And it's, you know, since we all have home studios, it's not a, you know, we're not going into it's a cheaper process to record.
Let's Get the Band Back Together. Now, this is a tune you recorded yourself, or at least released yourself, back in 2012, and you made a really fun video for it back then. Did you have to get the Crinkles permission to use it?
I did. I have to get the Crinkles. You know, that's one of the things we were discussing, like when what songs you want to record, and I presented Let's Get the Band Back Together, and everybody said, well, this is obvious. We got to record this.
Yeah.
Of course, we had to dictatorize it. You know,
yeah.
I think we did. It sounds like Dictators. It's a pretty exhilarating tune, I think.
Very. And I guess we should let people know here that in the video that you had done when you released the song back in 2012, the story for the video is this fictitious band called The Crinkles. Let's talk about that for a second. Who were the guys in that video?
The singer is Dave Hill. Well known to me. He's a comedian and a musician in New York, and the other guys were friends of my wife who helped me write the script.
And
that was a fun video to make and to write and produce. Actually, it was a little movie.
Well, right. You had the song when you came up with the song idea. Was there any inkling in your mind that maybe one day the Dictators would do it?
I guess I'd say there was an inkling. Yeah, I'd say there was.
So my notes say on the backing vocals, you have Tish and Snooky. And I double-checked with our own Speedy John Carlucci. He does overnights here in the Underground Garage on the weekends. Because he used to work for Manic Panic. And I
thought
those names were familiar to me, like being like the gals who run Manic Panic. They're longtime friends of yours. How did you get them involved with the recording?
Oh, just... Longtime friends. They used to be in Blondie, actually. And they now play in a band called the Sick Fucks. And they've been, you know, New York fashion icons since the 70s. And they, you know, they have this company, Manic Panics, Long Hair Dye, very well-known company. And they also sing. You know, they've been singing with me and Albert. And, you know, just, hey, let's put some female backing vocals. It was no Joyce except Tish and Snooky for us.
Yeah. So they, you mentioned them being in Blondie at some point. Did they ever have their own group separate from Blondie back in the late 70s?
Not really. They did the Sick Fucks, which is like a jokey kind of fun band, obviously.
So are they still in New York?
Yes, they're in New York.
Okay. Well, the lyric in your single from January, Goddamn New York, is I'm selling out, I'm breaking free from Brooklyn, Bronx, Manhattan, and Queens. Does that relate to you moving out of New York City to Hudson Valley?
Yeah. It was sort of, you know, I'm born and raised in New York City. I've written songs about New York. I never thought I would live anywhere else. But as I come into my 60s, I wanted a different lifestyle, and me and my wife decided to move upstate to sort of a slower, less crowded lifestyle. And it's sort of part of the song is about what New York is now and why I'm leaving. And so, yes, there is a reference to moving upstate.
I think it's a very clever idea, reflecting on the current form of New York City as being filled with scum but the scummy imagery is one of, you know, rich folks in chain stores as opposed to the post-apocalyptic land of, the early mid-70s.
I also say someday you'll recover.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. Yeah. You also sing about New York City one day recovering. What does it need to do to recover?
Well, I think it has to maybe, you know, one reason... There was such a great artistic movement in New York City in the 70s, is that the rents were cheap. Yeah. Right now, New York is ridiculously expensive. Brooklyn is even more expensive than Manhattan. You got to get the rents down a little bit, make it for middle-class people to live there, you know, and I think it's got to do a little dip and then it'll come back, my personal opinion.
It was funny when I first moved out to Los Angeles, this is like 2006 before the housing bubble burst. there was this woman who was a publicist, and the Woggles were putting out a record with Stephen, and this woman was just a terrible publicist. She was paid lots of money. I don't know why he hired her. She was terrible. But anyway, she was lamenting how expensive it was to live out here at that point. And she was saying, you know, I don't want anybody to be hurt, but, you know, just a little bump, a good little good shake of the walls, you know, get some pictures falling off, and that'll drive the prices back down, you know. But then, of course, the bubble burst, and prices did really drop for a while. But that hasn't happened with the pandemic thing, though. I'm stunned that the cost of living out here, these rents and stuff, are still way, way too high.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's why a lot cheaper where I am right now. So I understand in New York, homes are selling, but rents have come down. That's what I'm reading. But that's what, you know, that's secondhand information.
Tish and Snooki, are they singing backing vocals on Goddamn New York?
You got these. Yes. I tell you, they made that song. They just put that song over the top as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
Well, oohs and ahs, I can't get enough of those.
Yeah. But they sing in a New York attitude and New York accent. And, you know, the best background vocals in the world, they would have done it better than Snooki did it.
Well, man, Andy, it's always so good to speak with you. Thanks for talking with me again on our Coolest Conversations.
Oh, my pleasure, Manfred.
Thank you very much. We're going to give your single from January Spin Now. Here's The Dictators with Goddamn New York in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Walking down these dirty streets, can't avoid the sybaritic creeps. Now the oligarch shop for bling, where the chunkies used to sing, they go. I made my bones and never strayed from the town where I was born and raised, down the canyons of steel and glass.
New York. That's The Dictators here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with their single from this past January. Thanks again to frontman Andy Chernoff for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. Join me next time when I'll check in with Kevin Preston. He's a lead singer and guitarist in the Los Angeles-based band Prima Donna. They have a new single out on Wicked Cool Records called Atomic Love. We'll talk about that track and also the band's upcoming plans on your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it be bad, baby, diamond ring.